The seventh day of Pesach, which in Israel, I'm going to make you very happy now, is the last day of Pesach, and here not so. The seventh day of Pesach is traditionally ascribed, as we heard in the Torah reading, of the story of the Israelites actually leaving Egypt, and that is exiting from the borders of the empire, having the Egyptian army once again tracking them down. And the idea, of course, that the exodus from Egypt, culminating on the seventh day, mirrors another primordial kind of story in the biblical tradition. That primordial story is the story of Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden. We told also that on the seventh day, at the end of the seventh day, that they were expelled from the gilded cage that the garden was, that they were cast out into the world, forced into the conditions of living that you and I still live in today. And so the idea that Adam and Eve were created, formed, truly made as human beings only by being expelled from Eden, so too we begin to see the corollary, the similarities of the Israelites leaving Egypt, and only then could they become Jews. But the story that we read actually in the Torah has a lot of echoes to it. And there's one beat I want to draw your attention to that has been thought over, gnawed at, imagined over. It fills richly the Jewish imagination to the point that we read about this in our prayers every day. And so I'm going to task you, hopefully you'll forgive me, I'm going to task you to open up your Chumashim once again. We're going to look briefly into the text, to page 267, please. And this section of the Torah reading brings us to when Pharaoh has a change of heart, and part of it is it's inspired because he's looking at the exit of the Israelites and he's making an assumption that they're lost or confused or having doubts and second guessing themselves, and he figures, well, now's the time to go get them. Either we'll bring them back alive or we'll leave them there dead, but it'll send a message for sure, at least to anybody else who considers to do this. And as Pharaoh approaches, beginning on verse 10, and Pharaoh, he grieves, and Pharaoh comes closer, v'yisu b'nei Yisrael et neihem, and the children of Israel cast their eyes upwards, in other words, heaven bound, v'hinei Mitzrayim noseh achareihem, and the Egyptians are coming after them, v'yiru ma'od, and they became greatly afraid, v'yitzak'u b'nei Yisrael el Adonai, and they cried, praying unto God. And then they turn to Moses, of course, and they say the following: are there no graves in Egypt? You took us out here to die in the desert. What was the point of bringing us here to take us out of Egypt? Isn't this is what we told you before in Egypt, that it was a waste of time to try to leave and go and set us free? Because it was okay, because we could have just died there. And in verse 13, Moses turns to the people and says, and this expression is repeated many, many times over the biblical record, Al tira'u, do not be afraid. Hityatzvu, stand. Uru et yeshuat Adonai, and look at the salvation of God that will come your way today. As you see the Egyptians, so too thou, you will no longer see them again. That God will wage war for you, and then you will reap its rewards. And then in verse 15, God turns to Moses and says, Ma titzak elai, why are you crying, praying to me? Daber al b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, and go. V'yatah harem et matcha, unatei et yadecha al hayam uvakehu. Lift your staff, spread your hands, and the waters shall be parted. This idea of the Kriyat Yamsuf, or the parting of the Red Sea, is frequently, not only in traditional rabbinic writings, but even today, it becomes the sine qua non, it becomes the classic example of divine intervention in the world, of miracles that happen. One of the reasons why we are told in our tradition that we read the story in the Az Yashir in our prayer every day is to cultivate the hopefulness of miracles that should and hopefully will occur in our life. That in traditional Jewish communities, that when people are facing trying and difficult, nearly, may I say, impossible stakes in their life, that the traditional guidance is that they should read the section from the Torah, recite the Az Yashir. In some respects, that what would happen? That the miracle that happened then, which seemed so impossible, would happen now. The idea of what we view to be miracles, however, is a tricky thing. I'll give you an example. If someone was to come back forward into future, say from 500 years ago, and they were to see you take out something out of your pocket and make a phone call, what would they say? That's a miracle. To this very day, and it's decades later, by the way, when you watch the grainy film of Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon, what do you say? That's miraculous. In other words, on some level, first of all, the truth is, the more you see something incredible, the less miraculous it becomes. We know that. How many times do you go to an airport, step on a plane, it's like, oh, I can't believe it. This plane is leaving 20 minutes late. And it's like, sometimes I say to myself, buddy, you're going to fly 35,000 feet in the sky at like 700 kilometers an hour. You're like starting off in Toronto and you're going to end up in, I don't know, Florida, New York, Israel. I go, that's a miracle. So you're going to be 20 minutes late. The problem with us is, like so many things, we do this with people, we do this with things in our life. Miracles stop being miracles when you get used to it. But the truth is, on a deeper level, that rabbinic tradition had deep questions about this story. I'm going to point one out to you, famously so. The point being that if God was making a miracle to part the waters, why is it that God waited and commanded for Moses first to lift the staff, the rod that was in his hand, and spread it over the water? And not only that, but at the conclusion of the story, the waters don't go back to their original condition, pending only God telling Moses again to bring your hands together and lower your staff. What's the point of that? On some level, even in the story of this remarkable miracle, there's an additional seed that is planted. A seed that the ancient rabbis point is using in the expression, "Ein somchin al hanes," that we're not allowed to rely on miracles in our life. In other words, don't expect miracles to come your way, they're saying. Don't live your life as if something special is going to come and bail you out of a problem. If you want to solve your problems in life, God turns to Moses and says, don't scream, don't pray to me. Lift your hand up, part the waters, and get the people going. In other words, the deeply embedded Jewish tradition is that while we have a deep fervent kind of association, that there's something deeply powerful operating in the world, we don't live our life like that. Or, as the 20th century Jewish theologian Max Kedushin once said, Judaism promotes something called normative mysticism. Live normally, but don't be blind to the special things that can happen in life. Later on in Jewish tradition, both from Maimonides and then perhaps a philosopher that you've heard of, Baruch Spinoza, they said even something else. They said, if you want to go see a miracle in this world, you want to see a miracle, you don't have to talk about the parting of the Red Sea. Spinoza says, when you wake up in the morning, look outside your window. Look at the sun rising. At night, look at the stars in the sky. Look now in the springtime, how the flowers are blooming. He goes, God deeply embedded in the fabric of everything that is created is the miracle. For me, I'm not in any way dismissing those two beautiful categories of thought. But I want to share with you a story that meant a lot to me. He told it to me firsthand. It was the late and wonderful American rabbi and author, Harold Kushner, who wrote the beautiful book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And Rabbi Kushner tells the following story. And it is an echo, I think, of what we hear this morning when God tells Moses to turn to the people. Kushner tells, and horribly so, about how his firstborn son was born with a terminal illness. And he was working and living in a congregation in Massachusetts that was a few hours' drive out of Boston. And the requirement to drive his son often back and forth to one of the children's hospitals in Boston was quite taxing on their family. And so he applied for a job in one of the big shuls in Boston. Applied for the job, he went for the interview, went on a Shabbat. Anyway, in the end, he doesn't get the job. And him and his wife were absolutely crestfallen because they believed that if they lived closer to the hospital, the care and treatment of their son would be immeasurably improved. And that night, he said he was crestfallen and depressed, and he got a phone call, and it was friends of theirs, and said, we're going to be at your house in a half hour. Get dressed. We're taking you out for dinner. And he says, we're not in the mood to go out right now. And they said, we're coming. And they hung up the phone. They picked them up. They go out for dinner. They buy one bottle of wine. They buy a second bottle of wine. They buy a third bottle of wine. They basically drop him and his wife off on the front step of their home. And he said, the next morning when I woke up, through my headache, I realized what had happened. That the God answers us in the people he sends our way. And of course, we all need to see ourselves in that way. Not only to see the miracles of the people who are around us, but better also is to remind yourself of the miracle that you can be to the people that you surround. Chag Sameach. Please rise, page 350.